So water in motion, that's today's topic in order to address the problem of circulation of knowledge at various levels. The water issues I have in mind are issues that are interconnected in the Venetian cosmos of early modernity, sea tides, hydrogeology, and fish knowledge. I'll try to make it the connection between these different realms as plausible as possible. But first, let me start from the cosmos in the real sense. So water has always been a cosmological issue in the Middle Ages and in early modernity. So coming from a project, the Berlin one, on pre-modern and early modern cosmology, I'd like to start from the frontispiece, the first pages of Galileo's Dialogo, the Copernican dialogue on the two chief world systems, to remind us that water played a crucial role in his argument in favor of Copernican astronomy, as he in fact thought he would it would be suited to call his dialogue initially Discourse on the Ebb and Flow of the Sea, since the motion of sea tides was considered by himself as one of the strongest arguments in favor of the motion of the earth, as he himself claims in the dialogue in the fourth day of the dialogue itself. In the conversation of these 4 days, Galileo concludes, at some point we have then strong evidence in favor of the Copernican system, and a very strong argument is taken by the ebbing and flowing of the sea tides. But the cosmos I have in mind today is a more socio-cultural one that is connected with Venice. Venice is a very important city for Galileo's science. Remember that he was a professor at Padua when he carried out his most famous astronomical observations through the telescope, and he used to spend much time and intellectual exchange in Venice itself, especially in this part of the city, the Arsenal, where he confronted with technicians and practical fields of knowledge production of the time. So what is the watery cosmos I'm going to talk about today? It's basically three topics, as I stressed already from the title: three dimensions of water knowledge, taking into account its bearers, who are the knowers, who are the subjects of this knowledge, and what are the forms of its circulation. Sea tides, waterscape engineering, and ichthyology, fish knowledge. First of all, sea tides. As you can already perceive from this image and more or less the stereotypes, the commonplaces about Venice today, sea tides is a very crucial issue. But not only today, also in the past. So in the time of the flourishing of the printing press in Venice, many books on the phenomenon of tides were printed in Venice. This is just an example. We have here a book by the mathematic professor at Padua, Federico Delfino, De fluxu et refluxu aquae maris, which deals with the problem of, or with the issue of sea tides. It's considered to be a cosmological one. Therefore, sea tides have to be understood against the background of planetary motions. The conjunctions of the sun and the moon are considered very important in the Middle Ages and in early modernity, as they are today, but we don't call them conjunctions anymore. It's more about gravitation. This is academic culture, this is printing culture, but in the background there is a sort of widespread knowledge, or better than widespread knowledge, about the local settings, and very specific knowledge by technicians. This is a drawing, a manuscript by Cristoforo Sabadino, who is one of the most important water technicians from the Republic of Venice, who produced plenty of wonderful manuscripts, dialogues, tracts, and graphic representations of the lagoon. Here you are a diagram of his showing the motions of the sun and the moon as a means to understand sea tides in Venice. As you see, the very local setting of his own town, Venice, is included in a cosmic conception. The whole earth, the elements, and planetary motions, including the Moon and the Sun. As you see, the setting is still a pre-Copernican one. This is the sort of sources I'm particularly interested in, because they show the linkage between technical practical knowledge, that's why I call it practical cosmology, the implementation of cosmic knowledge, in this case, for the uses of the management of the Laguna of Venice. Cristoforo Sabadino belonged to the Magistrate for the Waters. This is a Renaissance institution that lived for centuries and who was in charge of everything that had to do with water. Water management in the lagoon, diversion of rivers, and the checking of the coastal line of Venice and the northern Adriatic. So in these manuscripts, in the archives and in the libraries, in this case we are in the Biblioteca Nazionale Marciana in Venice, in the National Library Marciana, that preserves Bessarion's codices among many other precious books. It also includes diagrams like this one. This is a sort of visualization of the different phases of the moon and the way they affect the water levels. So it's one of those gadgets that a technician like Sabadino prepared for himself in order to have an overview about the relevant local phenomena in their correct framework. He was also an astrologist, so we have astrological diagrams among his papers bound together with his more technical writings. And when I say technical writings, I mean that in a sense that we would be ready to accept today without any doubt. He used sort of triangulation techniques to measure distances in the lagoon of Venice, in Venice itself and in the lagoon, using instruments like this one that he draws and describes in his manuscripts. What is interesting to me is to show the connection between his very practical work, his mindset, fantastic drawings and maps like the one you can see here, also aesthetically incredibly beautiful. They were all preserved in the archives. They constituted a sort of secret knowledge, secret in the sense that it was very sensitive information about the territories of Venice. And at the same time, he engaged with theoretical aspects, with broader global insights. For instance, you have here a representation of the whole world. I think we are in the mid 16th century, in which you see America, you see the Far East, and this is just the drawing he drew in order to show himself or his collaborators the position or the direction of the various winds. So the issue that interests me specifically is the connection between the institutions, the knowledge that was produced and maintained in Venice, institutions like the Magistrate for the Waters, but also other ones. There are wonderful studies also by colleagues of ours in Berlin. I'm thinking of Jürgen Renn and Matteo Valeriani, who looked at the Arsenal of Venice as a very important setting for technical and practical knowledge in the construction of the Galilean science in the 16th and 17th centuries. And myself, I'm bringing to your attention another institution, the institution of water management, the Magistrate for Waters, with similar questions in mind. How does academic codified science relate to the knowledge that is preserved in such places like the Arsenal and like the Magistrate for the Waters? And this leads me to my second topic. Let me call it waterscape architecture or landscape engineering. The Magistrate of the Waters that produce maps like this one you see in the background. This is a map of the canals in the Lagoon of Venice that shows the navigability, the places where ships could navigate the lagoon. The Magistrate for Waters that produced this sort of documentation is very much responsible for the Lagoon of Venice as it is today. In fact, in the 16th century, it was decided, it was a political, economic, and a shared decision to preserve the lagoon as it is. And the preservation of the lagoon very much depended of constant engineering, constant landscape reworking. The most important aspect is to avoid, or was to avoid, the infillment of the lagoon through sediments brought by the rivers. So the magistrate for the waters and the Venetian authorities throughout the centuries diverted all major rivers from the lagoon to the outside sea, to the Adriatic, so that the infillment would not transform the lagoon into mainland. So here you see, for instance, Brenta, that was diverted in the 17th century outside of the lagoon. Here you see Piave, that was also diverted. And basically all of the rivers that used to come to the lagoon were taken away from it during the early modern time. Therefore, we still have Venice as an island in the middle of sort of lake-like setting in which salty water has prevailed. In the archives of Venice, we find plenty of interesting documents. The whole documentation by the magistrate for waters is there and still is waiting for close reading and further studies. You find a sort of projects about how to construct canals, how to guarantee the preservation of the lagoon itself. And it was a constant work. So in this case, for instance, somebody proposed to create new canals in the lagoon to excavate them. And excavations is very much part of the work of this magistrate. What I'm interested in is also to introduce other social actors in this story. So we have the academicians, the university professors, the scholars like Galilei. We have the technicians of the magistrate for the water. We also have the people. We have the fishermen, for instance, the fishermen community that plays a very important function. It is a function that is acknowledged by the water magistrate. For instance, we have this document from 1536 in which it is decided by the water technicians that since, and I quote, "no one understands better the course and the movements of the waters of our lagoon than the fishermen who travel through it by day and by night, the community chief, who was called the Gastaldo, and the school of fishermen of San Nicolò," that's the part of the city where the fishermen used to live, "shall choose two of the most sensible and practical elderly fishermen or former fishermen. All fishing communities, all communities of fishermen from the lagoon should send their people, and these people should be asked about their knowledge and opinions in moments of technical decisions that concern also the fishing community." Very interesting point. Here you are a few images about the community I'm talking about. Grevenbroich's 18th century depiction of the chief of the fishermen community, the Gastaldo, a colorful image of a festivity in which the fishermen community from San Nicolò met on the Ponte dei Pugni, on this sort of boxing bridge, community coming from Castello, the other part of the city, and threw each other in the water. So you have an image of also of this life of the city that involves the fishermen community in a very colorful manner. Fishermen were interviewed by the water magistrate on several occasions. So, for instance, I found questionnaires that were prepared by the water magistrates in order to address and ask fishermen opinions on, for instance, in this case, on the diversion of the Brenta River in 1610. Fishermen should tell about their fishing, about the changes they observed in the water flows, in the water levels. And they were also asked to give their opinion about the benefits or the disadvantages of engineering interventions in the lagoon of Venice. So my question is then, who is the expert? think it's very interesting to see fishermen also as experts in this Republican context I'm talking about. The fishermen have a very specific knowledge. They have knowledge of the territory. They have knowledge of the lagoon, of the waters, and they are asked to give their opinion on relevant issues that concern the whole city community. But there are also other experts. For instance, Benedetto Castelli. Benedetto Castelli, who is one of the most famous pupils by Galilei, he was also asked to give his opinion, his advice on water issues in the lagoon of Venice in the 17th century when the sea levels were lowering and the Venetians were very concerned about the fact that the lagoon was getting too shallow. Castelli came to Venice and gave his famous authoritative assessment. I found a manuscript copy of his considerazione, of his consideration about the state of the lagoon, which is a sort of old new source of geoenvironmental management. It was published posthumously in Italian and translated in many languages, including in English. For instance, the English edition 1661 was published together with Galileo's Dialogue. So it was a text that had a wide European circulation. Castelli himself was a famous mathematician, the mathematician of the Pope of Urban VIII, professor in Rome, and as I said, a pupil of Galileo, who is considered to be one of the founders of the science of hydraulic. His De la misura dell'acqua corrente is a famous work in which he provides new means, new technical and mathematical means for the measurement of water rate and water levels. His advice was to bring rivers back to the lagoon to have more water. And he measured with accuracy the quantity of water that Brent and other rivers brought to the lagoon. Nonetheless, the Venetians rejected his advice. We have a letter of his in which he complains about the rudeness of the reaction by the Venetians. So in 1641, he presented to the Senate his vistas, and he writes, "When in obedience to your sovereign command, I did in full college represent my thoughts touching the state of the Lake of Venice," that's the early modern English translation, the senators fell furiously upon me, and by violent means, both with the pen and press full of gall, did abuse me in reward of the readiness that I had expressed to obey and serve them. So what is the problem? The problem is that Castelli gave a very accurate measurement of water quantities, but he forgot the geological setting, the whole. He forgot the sea levels and the lagoon levels are connected. So the levels of the Lagoon of Venice, can you follow me, right? Yeah, so that the sea levels and the lagoon levels are connected, and one cannot expect that an increase of waters flowing from the rivers would increase the levels of the lagoon. Moreover, Castelli forgot basic knowledge like the infillment effect of sediments brought by the rivers. So he was rejected by the Venetians. And he expressed a sort of aristocratic mathematical scorn for what I would call his failed revolution in the management of the Lagoon of Venice. And he writes in a way that echoes certain debates that are also connected with Galileo's figure. "I have ever more esteemed one conclusion, well managed and well considered by one understanding man, although alone, than the common and vulgar opinions. In such cases, the opinion molded and framed by the most ignorant and stupid vulgar have been ever suspected by me as false. I chanced to propose a thing that was totally contrary to the most received and antiquated opinions." So in a way, he is expressing a sort of, let me say so, a sort of technocratic position towards the management of the lagoon. And he is discrediting the sort of shared opinions by Venetians, calling them vulgar opinions. So my further question is, who are these vulgars he's speaking about? And I'm thinking especially of the fisherman community. And now we will look at another field of expertise in which fishermen, of course, are crucial, knowledge about fish. So this is a sort of form of knowledge about water, water resources, and the production of food, depending on the good management of the lagoon. And in fact, we have a long history of documentation legislation concerning fishing. Here you are, a document from the archives from the 18th century that expressed a eulogy of the capacity of the Venetians to regulate fishing in the past. It says, I quote, "Our ancestors' wisdom, with excellent and beneficial decisions, always aimed at regulating the fishing of the new fish, because on this depends to a great extent the abundance and essential food. Thus, they determine the time, places, and uses of nets and techniques. The fishermen themselves should take an interest in such a serious subject. It is their own interest, because if the fish can grow and is caught only in the appropriate and permitted seasons, this produces a joyful abundance for the universal benefit and the happiness of abundant fishing. So the regulation of fishing is important for the fishermen themselves and for the whole community." And we have plenty of sources on this in the archives. For instance, this Renaissance source. It's a collection of decisions from the 16th century about the about fishing itself, ordini concerning fishing. Just to give you an idea of the sort of laws and the sort of knowledge that these regulations include. This is one rule, for instance. No one should dare to take the fish go. This is a fish that is typical of the Lagoon of Venice, with the hands when it lays its eggs. And then the times of the year are mentioned when this fish that you can see here in this picture, it's the central one. This is fish from Venice that is still eaten today in a special risotto from Venice. This reproduces in the spring, so no one should walk on the places where the eggs were put in the specific times of the year. My question here is, here you have a drawing by an erudite, Ippolito Salviano, published in Rome in the 16th century. My question would be, how much of the knowledge that comes from fisher communities about the reproduction cycles of fish, about the habits of the fish, about their life, flew into academically more formalized knowledge? I don't have an answer, but this is a working question that is very important to me. What is sure is that in these sort of legal sources, we'll find a lot of embedded knowledge, which in my view comes from fishing practices and needs to be extracted and evaluated also from the viewpoint of the history of science and ideas. So for instance, this is another passage of the same Renaissance source that says that it is totally forbidden to take menole, the fish you see here, in Istria, so northern Adriatic, today's Croatia, during the time when they breed and lay eggs, especially in the months of March, June, July, and August. So very strict regulations connected with knowledge about the life cycles of the watery species. Specific techniques of fishing are forbidden. Thick nets are perpetually forbidden because they catch nascent and juvenile fish, the small fish that has to reproduce and grow for the benefit of the city and the collectivity. So we cannot allow wrong techniques to exterminate an infinite number of fish that should be able to be let grow. Here you are a few images from the 19th century about fishing of juvenile fish. So you see it has been more or less liberalized in the 20th century. These are the techniques that the Venetians prohibited for centuries. Here you are the small fish. The regulation about fishing is very old. The eldest sources I found are from the 14th century. Here you are a transcription. There is a sort of continuity. It's very consistent, the sort of legal decisions. So it seems that there has been centuries of strict regulations that are based on the assumption that the rhythms of economy and the rhythm of life of the species in the water should be harmonized. It's a very important teaching. So Helge mentioned the Anthropocene debate. It's a very important case to be studied in order to look at the sustainable economy, a sustainable management of economical and food resources. What we have here is a sort of long-durée perspective on fishing, preserved in folders like the one you see to your right. And as I said, my main question is the question of looking at the knowledge that is embedded in this legal documentation, how much practical knowledge is embedded in fishing legislation, and how much of this knowledge was then codified and brought to the attention of the learned communities at universities and those publishing scientific books. That relates, in my view, also to the question in the Venetian context about the specific political settings. So is there a connection between this sort of shared circulating knowledge between classes and groups in Venice and the specific Republican, and its specific Republican context? That's a working hypothesis. I'm very much in favor of embracing it. But for the time being, I'll just add a few remarks about how to conceive water in this Republican context, in this early modern context, or better to say, in this medieval and early modern context as a common that was protected in the interest of various groups, including, first of all, the fishermen. In the 18th century, and there's plenty of such proclamations, the city of Venice declared that, and I quote, "the public domain of waters must be kept free in the public waters." So, and this is a proclamation that we find in many documents, "no one without exception shall prevent for any reasons or pretext any subject, and especially the faithful fishermen and inhabitants of San Nicolò, from public fishing." So there is a sort of defense of the commons, and the water of the lagoon is considered one of those commons. Everybody, especially the fishermen, should be free of using it for fishing. It was a very important resource for everyday life of these communities, not just for work, but also for their life. If somebody contravened this prohibition, half of the sum, this is a typical practice, half of the sum should go to the complainant, the other half to the public sphere, to the city, to the institutions, and in particular should be used for lagoon excavations. So you see that the interests of the water magistrate in the preservation of the water levels and the lagoon of Venice is connected here with the fishing interest of the fishing community. We have many interesting documents to be explored in view of the problem of the aquae publicae and public dominion of the waters, or better to say, of waters as a common. A very interesting document is the one you see here to your right, published in 1684, and this is the last document I will consider today. It's very interesting because it shows specific Republican alliances between different subjects in the city of Venice. The legislators, the technicians, and the fishermen. The document starts, it's a proclamation, it starts like this. "It is intended to fulfill the duties of the magistrate for the waters and obey the decrees of the most excellent Senate, which followed the plea of the faithful people of San Nicolò." So you see the three main actors. The legislator, the technician, and the fisherman. They have common interests. This common interest is the interest to defend and protect the common use of the waters. For this aim, the proclamation of 1684 imposes that one has, or that should, the public waters should be distinguished and separated in a neat manner from those claimed by privates with titles, particularly the owners of the so-called valli da pesca, which I translate as fishing enclosures. It's enclosed areas where fishing is more or less privatized. This is the sort of valli da pesca, of enclosures. They still exist in the Lagoon of Venice. This is a 20th century representation. Moreover, and that's another interesting connection that connects to cartography, to mapping and drawing, which we saw in the case of Sabadino. True and precise drawing of public and private waters should be produced. They should constitute a sort of registry that should be provided by the magistrate for the waters. So we see that cartographic projects connected with the ownership of waters, their right, their use are closely intertwined. Once the public is separated from the private, may the people of San Nicolò, that is the fishermen, and Chioggia, other fishermen, and all subjects universally benefit from the reserved and permitted fishing. So I conclude a few remarks to introduce also the, or to offer you some topics for further reflection and conversation. First of all, the political background. So the question that I have in mind is whether we can assume that there is a sort of republican a priori for science and the knowledge about the waters in Venice. I think the historical cases I briefly consider offer us evidence that goes in that direction. There are specific conditions of the science or of the knowledge in Venice that can be better understood if we take into account the way that the republican settings shape the production of knowledge, its preservation and its circulation. My second point concerns water as a common, and the water knowledge that is connected to it is a sort of common knowledge. By that I don't mean something like shared knowledge. I don't claim that everybody owned or benefited from the same access to knowledge. I say common knowledge because I think it's more interesting to look at the field of conversation and debate than about the specific knowledge that specific actors and institutions own. And so the idea of common is the idea of a shared space of exchange in which different actors with different subjects, with different knowledge, can enter a fruitful exchange. And I think the reason of speaking about common knowledge about the water in this sense is very much based on the assumption that water is a common in this pre-modern and early modern context. As far as circulation is concerned, the circulation of knowledge, I'd like to point to dimensions, two directions. One is the academic one. I pointed to Seatides publications, for instance. They could be traced. There is a large body of publications on this that allow us to see the circulation of certain works and certain ideas. The other dimension is the social one, the roots of this knowledge and the way academic knowledge or local knowledge pollinate each other. And when I say social settings or social circulation, I literally mean the circulation between the different social groups of a community. In our case, fishermen, technicians, professors, policymakers. And finally, water cosmology, that brings me back to the cosmology project that I worked on for years in Berlin in the context of the of our SFB. We can see water as a cosmological issue, of course. It's very important. So it's a connection between Helge and my research on resources and the cosmos. And I think what is also interesting to point out is that water is not a cosmological issue only in the strict astronomical sense or planetary sense. Of course, that plays a role. But I tend today to look at that as a problem of a cosmos of practices and ways of living. And I really hope that my contribution today, my talk today, could make the point plausible to all of us. And I conclude with this nice mosaic from Roman times about fishing in the northern Adriatic.